Few places on Earth can rival the astonishing diversity of plant and animal life found in Indonesia, that collection of tropical islands stretched across a vast crescent. The abundance inspired British naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace to pen the first scientific paper arguing the theory of evolution with his now far more famous co-author, Charles Darwin. Wallace died 100 years ago this year. NPR's Anthony Kuhn takes us to the island of Sulawesi, where the scientist made some of his most profound observations.
Wallace arrived here more than 150 years ago in what was then the Dutch East Indies. During his eight-year expedition, he would collect over 100,000 plant and animal species. Tony Whitten with the British-based Flora and Fauna International says that on his journey, Wallace was constantly battling tropical disease and bad weather, but his mind was on other things.
When he was working, he would have just forgotten about the pain and the damp and the wet and the mold, and he was just totally absorbed in what he was doing and just found life around him amazing.
When Wallace landed here on Sulawesi in 1859, he had already co-authored his paper with Darwin, but he was still refining his ideas about evolution. And he was fascinated to be on an island where most of the animals existed no place else on Earth. Today, Sulawesi's natural abundance has been severely depleted. Many of its unique species are close to extinction in the wild. You can only find them in nature preserves like this one. Here we have a signboard. This is the Boganinani Wartabone National Park. I'm looking for a bird called the Maleo. Wallace's search for this bird was the high point of his explorations on Sulawesi. Okay, so we're going to have to be really quiet when we approach the Maleo. Otherwise, they're going to bolt. We're just going to have to talk very quietly. We're walking through sort of highland forest, and we're lucky to be here on a day where it's very cool and misty with a light rain coming down. Wallace's observations about the Maleo helped to build his understanding of evolution, but they also capture this man's limitless curiosity. Wallace wrote that we should never be content to look at a living thing and say, "Oh, that's just the way it is." We should always be inquiring about how it got that way and how it's related to its environment.
I tried to find the Maleo.
With me is Park Ranger Max Layla. I ask him, what does the Maleo's call sound like?
Mau mencari bunyi, dia bersuara. Biasanya mereka.
Maleo usually comes in a couple. The male Maleo will sound like.
Nah, itu bunyi yang jantan.
Female Maleo will sounds like.
Hak, hak, hak. Oh yeah, the Maleo.
I've lost it now.
Big three. First branch.
There they are, two male Maleos perching in a tree, calling to their mates. Their size is somewhere between a chicken and a turkey, with black feathers and a salmon-colored breast. Wallace observed that Maleos have adapted so perfectly to their environment that they even use Sulawesi's geology to survive. Instead of sitting on their eggs like hens, Maleos use geothermal energy to incubate them. They dig into the earth, which is heated by hot springs. They can sense where the temperature is between 86 to 97 degrees. That's where they lay their eggs. That's two in stereo, a very animated conversation. Now we're at the park's hatchery, and Layla is showing us a two-day-old Maleo chick. He's putting the downy little bird in my hand, and this gives us a chance to see how its body has adapted to its environment. Touching the feathers on the back of the little Maleo's neck, and they're very soft and downy. The Maleo's feet that we're looking at right now, the legs are straight, and the claws, it's got four fingers with webbing in between two of them, and that's their shovel, that's what they use to dig. Layla says that after 8 weeks, the buried eggs hatch. It takes the Maleo chicks about 3 days to struggle up through 2 or 3 feet of dirt, pecking, flapping, and kicking their way out. They're able to fly away almost as soon as they reach the surface, and that keeps them safe from predators.
Anthony, you can release.
Okay. Off you go. So that bird sort of wobbled a bit on my right hand, and then with a push and shove, off it flew and roosted on a tree branch. Very impressive for a three-day-old bird. On Sulawesi, Wallace noticed something unusual, and that is that the Malayo is related to species found in Australia in the Western Pacific, hundreds or thousands of miles away, but not in Asia, not even on the island of Borneo, just a few miles to the west. So Tony Whitten says Wallace drew a line on the map to separate what seemed to him to be distinct regions with different kinds of animals. That line is now called the Wallace Line, and the region around it is called Wallacea.
It was clearly this sort of transition between the Asian world and the Australian world. And so came the thought of this line that could be drawn between Borneo and Sulawesi that would separate the Asian fauna from the Australian fauna.
Wallace didn't know it at the time, but his line is actually the divide between two continental shelves. Really, Wallace was just asking a simple question. Why do we find this animal in this place? At the Tassikokee Wildlife Rescue and Education Center, we meet up with local naturalist John Tassirin. And Tassirin says that you can see that process happening right here on Sulawesi.
You can see the movement of the animals, and when they move, then suddenly it becomes new species. Well, not suddenly. After, 3,000, 6,000 years later.
Even as Wallace's eyes observed life around him, his mind roamed millions of years back in time to imagine the birth of islands and continents. He also peered into the future. Wallace foretold today's situation in which Sulawesi's unique animals face extinction. He wrote that we have it within our power to save these creatures and not let them, as he put it, perish irrecoverably from the face of the earth, uncared for and unknown. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News.
All week here on Morning Edition, we've been talking coffee.
Coffee time. Let's listen to some jazz and rhyme and have a cup of coffee.
If you are hooked on coffee, as some of us are, you may want to listen closely. Coffee plants are facing threats, among others, disease and climate change. To protect them, scientists are looking to coffee's genes. Here's NPR's Dan Charles.
There's an agricultural research institute near Turrialba in Costa Rica where you can see and touch the history of coffee, maybe also part of its future. The coffee trees here, spread across 25 acres, take you back to coffee's origins.
So the story starts in Africa, no? East Africa.
Eduardo Somariba, a researcher at the Center for Tropical Agricultural Research and Education, CATIE, is walking me through long rows of small coffee trees. There's a wooden sign in front of the trees, Coffee Collection of Ethiopia. Every tree here has a number.
This is the number 4535.
Carlos Cordero, another scientist here, chooses tree number 4535 at random and looks up this entry in a catalog of the collection that he brought along. The seed that grew into this tree came from the highlands of Ethiopia, where this particular species of coffee, Coffea arabica, grows wild. Scientists from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization collected the seed in Ethiopia and brought it here 50 years ago.
Y fue introducida en el año 1965.
Introduced here in 1965. In June.
Not far away from this tree, Cartier also has samples of another coffee species, Coffea conifera, often called Robusta.
Which is basically what we see here, these trees over here.
The Robusta trees are bigger. They're also hardier than Arabica plants. They're widely grown in Vietnam and parts of Africa. But Robusta coffee has a bitter taste, and some purists look down on it. This whole collection is like a storage vault for a piece of coffee's ancient and wild African past. But the interesting thing about it is that today's commercial coffee production is based on only a tiny slice of it. Arab traders brought coffee plants from Africa to the Middle East and to Europe many centuries ago. In the 1700s, Europeans brought two lines of Coffea Arabica, two genetic types, to Latin America.
We got the Bourbon line and also the Typica line, and then combinations between these two, no?
These two types of coffee trees, just those two, are the ancestors of much of the coffee in Latin America and really in the world today. In fact, there's a lot more genetic variety in this one little field at Cartier than there is in all the coffee plantations of Central and South America. And that is part of the problem, because coffee faces some serious threats. A change in climate, for instance. Prime growing areas in the mountains will get hotter, and plants will suffer. Even more urgent right now is a problem called leaf rust.
See how many plants don't have leaves anymore?
Yeah.
That's leaf rust.
Emilia Umana, who works for the coffee trading company Ecom Trading, has stopped her car right in the middle of a lonely road in the Tarasu region of Costa Rica. Ahead of us, up on the side of a mountain, there's a swath of coffee bushes that have been stripped bare by disease. Leaf rust swept across much of Central America this past year, also parts of South America. Several countries have declared it a national emergency. Millions of farmers are looking for answers. One potential answer could be new varieties that can fend off the disease. A few such varieties already exist. Emilia Umana stops her car again.
Look at this plant. You see those little orange spots on the leaves?
Yeah.
That's leaf rust. And see the other ones that don't have any? Those are leaf rust resistant plants.
If I was a farmer, she says, I'd just plant these.
I mean, I love them. They're really tough. They're just like the John Deere of the coffee.
Unfortunately, this variety, called Catimor, is not perfect.
Many people don't like it. People say it doesn't taste as good.
In fact, some people say Catimor could be the downfall of coffee. One of its grandparents is from the Robusta side of the coffee family, and you can taste that Robusta bitterness in its beans. Researchers are hoping to create something better. A plant as tough as Catimor with beans sweet enough for any taste test. Maybe what they need to fight leaf rust or adapt to a warming planet are genes that are hidden in the collections of coffee trees at Cartier. Or maybe, says Cartier's Eduardo Somariba, it's out there in the forests of Africa where coffee still grows wild.
So we have to really go back to the forests, capture what is in the wild, bring them into the analysis of the science to really, in somehow, save this genetic variability.
Somariba says there's been very little money available for this. Very few of the coffee trees in Cartier's Ethiopian collection have been genetically analyzed. That's even more true of other coffee species, relatives of Arabica and Robusta. Somariba says these tropical trees are like neglected children.
Coffee and cocoa, some people call them orphan crops. Because really the development of them, despite their importance in trade, like we have a international center for maize and wheat, no? We don't have one for coffee.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe it's because it's in the tropics or something like that. I don't know.
Some people in the coffee industry now are saying this kind of neglect has to end. It's not just to fend off threats from leaf rust, for instance. Peter Giuliano from the Specialty Coffee Association of America says the genetic storehouse of Cartier's collections or in the wild may also contain treasures of taste.
One of the biggest stories of the last 5 years in coffee is the sort of discovery of this variety called geisha.
Geisha trees are the offspring of a coffee tree in Ethiopia that collectors brought to Cartier in Costa Rica in the 1950s. Seeds from that tree found their way to a farm in Panama. And then coffee connoisseurs found that this variety grown in that environment had a unique and wonderful taste.
Very quickly, this coffee from this farm became sort of a rock star in the coffee world.
It sold for incredible prices at auctions. And now coffee retailers are thinking maybe there are more varieties like this waiting to be uncovered. Earlier this month, Peter Giuliano organized a big meeting of the Specialty Coffee Association just about coffee genetics. Some of the biggest names in the high-end coffee business talked about leaf rust, about conserving what's left of forests in Ethiopia where Coffea arabica grows wild, also about breeding new varieties. Giuliano says it was a heavy dose of science for a room full of business people and coffee lovers.
But everyone was up for it and really inspired. And now we can make good decisions about how we want to grapple with these problems that we're facing.
They've already made one decision. Many coffee roasters, including some of the big ones, are helping to fund a new research institute called World Coffee Research. And one of its first projects is a genetic analysis of the coffee tree collections in Costa Rica at the research center called Cattier. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Later today, join us for a coffee clatch in NPR's virtual coffee house. At noon Eastern Time, Dan and Allison Aubrey, along with special guests from the series, will be answering questions in a Google Hangout. Get in on the conversation by going to npr.org/coffeehouse. This is NPR News.
As we just heard, President Obama mentioned evidence that chemical weapons have been used in Syria, but he said intelligence agencies are still seeking proof to back that up. In the meantime, a physicians' organization is trying to help medical workers in Syria recognize the signs of a chemical attack. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, their effort is meant to save lives, but it could also generate evidence that governments are looking for.
Proving that someone has violated the international taboo on chemical weapons can be very hard. Today, President Obama said, yes, there's evidence that someone used them in Syria's civil war. However,
we don't know how they were used, when they were used, who used them. We don't have a chain of custody that establishes what exactly happened.
If they have been used, Syrians are at risk. That's why Physicians for Human Rights is setting up a network to get fact sheets about chemical weapons into the hands of Syrian physicians. This group has a long record of working with medical professionals in trouble spots to protect civilians and reveal war crimes. The fact sheets list the symptoms of exposure to nerve gas, like sarin or VS, or to mustard gas. They explain how to treat people and how doctors can avoid being contaminated themselves. Susanna Serkin runs the group's international operations. She says getting this information to Syrians is also important to rule out false alarms.
There are times when symptoms may look to doctors as if they were caused by chemical warfare agents, and they might mistake other kinds of injuries and harms in a hot conflict with chemical warfare agents.
False alarms could cause panic or, as happened in Iraq, lead the U.S. to take military action based on inaccurate claims about weapons of mass destruction. The fact sheets also explain how to take samples of blood, urine, and hair from patients and preserve them as evidence.
Obviously, if these weapons are being used, have been used, or might be used soon, it's in everyone's interest that this be known and that they be identified.
That sample analysis would likely be done outside Syria. Alistair Hay is a toxicologist at the University of Leeds who's advised the British government on chemical weapons. He's also working with Physicians for Human Rights. Hay says the nerve agents leave a trail in the body. They attack a crucial enzyme that normally works like an on-off switch between nerves and muscles. A nerve gas eliminates the off signal.
Basically, it's on all the time. So you then get a whole range of effects, absolutely dreadful.
Terrible headaches, sweating, seizures, respiratory failure leading to death. But other ailments produce similar symptoms, pesticide exposure, for example. Hay says the gold standard of proof means tracking down the nerve agent itself in tissue samples.
Chemical nerve agent will be attached to the enzyme. It physically inactivates the enzyme and remains attached to it.
Physical samples of nerve agent in soil are harder to get because nerve gas evaporates quickly. But Hay and Physicians for Human Rights succeeded in doing that in 1992. They brought back soil and a contaminated piece of a bomb from northern Iraq, confirming that Saddam Hussein's forces gassed Kurdish civilians there. Hay notes, however, that getting samples is just the start. To make a legal case, whether it's against the Syrian government or opposition groups, you need an ironclad chain of custody.
You need to be able to have somebody swear, if you like, that the material was in their custody at all times, whoever it is with, before it gets to the laboratory.
For the moment, Physicians for Human Rights is focusing on educating Syrians about the health risks. The fact sheets are being circulated to people traveling in and out of Syria and are available on the group's website. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.